I'm sorry. The House is still in session.
Yeah, the House.
We're going to open the Senate Joint Committee. The Senate half of it. Student Success. The House is in on the floor, and we're hoping that some of the House members make it in and out based on when they look at a group of bills and they can slip down here for a while. I do have it on good authority that they will be watching this afterwards because this all gets taped, and so there is a way to see the whole thing. So, and they talked to me to make sure that they expressed to the people who are here today that they actually intend to do that. And knowing a couple who have missed have asked me questions about the previous tapes, I expect that that's what they will do because they would like to hear this information. It's just that we've made a decision here at the Capitol that we're going to be out tomorrow. And that has us moving. We did have this plan for a bit longer, but they have scheduled a Ways and Means. We have to go back on the floor in the Senate at 2:00, and then a Ways and Means meeting at 3:00. And at 1:30 today, there's a Rules Committee that I'm on that I have chosen not to vote for the Sunday Day Motion. I will stay here, but they think they have enough without me, so we're okay. So if you have some questions that you're going to have for these people, write them down. That's why the paper's here, because we may not have enough time to get through everything, and we will get answers to those questions to get stuff back to you. Because of the distance, we always have allowed at hearings to have the people who live the farthest away go first. So we're going to have Christy Perry, who is so far away, and Tim Sweeney, she happened to be with the right people, who's coming from Coquille. So we'll have them both come up here. And she knows how difficult it was for Coquille to get here since she grew up in Reedsport. So it's always fun to have both of you here from my perspective. And we're going to do an informational hearing, a meeting on school district budgeting process. People on our committee and asking questions have asked a little bit to have a better understanding of what the budgeting stuff is and all those kinds of things. As we go around, we'll have, hopefully that will key us to ask questions at the places we're going to go. Are we going to be able to give a short where we're going?
You can say probably the first one.
Okay. And we also have been working to figure out where we're going to start and where we're going to go. So right now we have amongst the four, five leaders we've had.
Three to five.
We have made the determination that the first meeting is going to be in the Eugene Springfield area, and it's going to happen on
March 22nd.
So March 22nd, Mike, put your calendars up. Eugene Springfield.
Isn't that?
That would also be.
Is that spring break?
No, it's the week before. That's exactly why it's not spring break. We were thinking about the week later, give us more time. That would have been spring break, so we moved it to be before spring break. There's also, at that same place, Willamette High School and the Bethel District. They're all there in the same place, and we are right now anticipating having some opportunities for people in smaller groups, not the whole group, go to different sites that they are, and we'll be putting together a list of what those things are. They have a military academy school in Springfield. They've got some early childhood, some other kinds of things, and some charter schools over in the Bethel District. There's different high schools. So we're going to try to get a list and break people up to go see it and come back and share us with information. Then in the evening, we'll have a meeting with the education and other stakeholders by themselves and a dinner. And then we'll go to a meeting with the community from about, what did we say, is it 6:30?
To be determined.
To be determined. We're working on all the timing so we can make that happen. So that is right now our first meeting. We're still working on the others. And again, if you have real strong feelings about anything, make sure Lisa knows. We've got a lot of input. And so it's really, we have made a decision. We're going to go across the width and breadth of our state. But we will also be trying to figure out the width and breadth of education opportunities that kids have from preschool through high school. And we want to find out things that are working, things that aren't working so well. Little schools, single A type schools to large schools, so people have an understanding of them. So that's what we have. Okay, so with that, we're gonna start with, and I don't care which one of you goes first. I guess we're up with Salem. Salem's going first.
All right. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Roblund, Co-Vice Chair Knopp, and members of the committee and those that are not with us today. My name is Christy Perry, and I'm the superintendent of Salem-Keizer School District. And formerly, before Salem-Keizer, I was a superintendent in Dallas School District. So this is my 13th year as an Oregon superintendent, and have been asked today to talk about budget law and how we interact with the budget process in our communities. And certainly, if there's more questions, we will get you back written responses as quick as you need them. So thank you for inviting us today. We know this is an important topic for you and for us. So first of all, I just want to orient you to Salem-Keizer School District. This is our by numbers infographic around our school district. We do have over 42,000 students. We're the second largest school district in Oregon. 65 schools, plus an alternative high school, plus a career technical education center, plus a number of auxiliary sites within our school district. Our general fund budget is over $479 million. That's just from general fund sources. When we add in all our federal dollars and other sources of revenue, we're about a $750 million operation in Oregon. Our student demographics, we're almost a 50% Caucasian, 50% minority district, and we have about 19% of our students who are ELL students, and the number changes daily, but we have about 79 different languages spoken in our school district. While we are the our numbers, our percentages might not show we're the district with the most poverty. We have probably the most students in poverty by the numbers. We also, by the numbers, have the greatest number of EL students. Just one fun fact, our buses drive almost the circumference of the world every day. We're a large geographic district with a lot of students versus a more urban district like Portland that has a smaller geography. It just impacts us differently in transportation. We have a high percentage of special education students, higher than the state average. What we know about our community is that they value music, career and technical education, athletics, extracurricular programs, including drama and the arts. And we have amazing community support. When you think about our Career Technical Education Center, we have probably about $11 to $15 million put into that facility that never came from the state school fund. So what a huge gift to our community in a facility that really moves the mark for kids. Another revenue source for us is a local option levy, and Salem-Keizer, just because of our property tax value base, isn't really a great candidate to either support a local option levy or to get a decent amount of revenue in a local option levy. And I just put it up there because we're talking about budget and it's part of our context. I put our strategic plan up here. I won't read it because I think that's really important in the budget process that you think about two things. What is your community value? What are your strategic goals for students? And then in the budget process, how do you budget in a way that can help maximize those priorities? I'd be a little remiss if I didn't talk about what moves a mark for our students. So what I will tell you is the single biggest factor in student success is the people. Strong teachers, strong mentors, strong adult supports that surround our students. The research is very clear that the strongest predictor of student learning and success and high school graduation is an effective teacher in every classroom across every grade level. And we all know how hard that is. And even in programs such as career technical education, college credit coursework in high school, STEM, the arts, athletics, all of that, when you come back at the end of the day and think about why do you have hundreds of kids in your music class, in your music programs, it's because of a really good teacher. So I just want to make sure we keep that the center of our conversation. So the budget development process for schools is both an internal and an external or community-based public process. We are clearly governed by local budget law, and we do you know, follow that to the T because it's important legally and it's important to our community. The strategic plan development and the understanding of local community values is really most important. And in that strategic planning process, you really have to think about where is your district, what are your challenges as far as student learning challenges, and where do you put your resources. So I'll just give you one real example right now. I know that one of our challenges in math is around guaranteed and viable curriculum in elementary. We desperately are in need of a math adoption. What I know about a math adoption is it's about $5 million. What I know as I look into next year is I don't know where I can find $5 million. So I've thought about what is my most important priority, but it comes down to do I fully fund a math adoption and take teachers out of classrooms to get that? And so that becomes the give and take as you're strategic planning and thinking about your budget process. So from a really kind of timeline point of view, we actually in Salem-Keizer start budgeting for the next fiscal year. It feels like about the first day of school of the given year. So we start in October through November or December really thinking about, you know, working on what do our programs look like? Are all our systems thriving? Do we have all the right numbers everywhere? What about the new staff? How do we get that into the system? And we also, during that time, appoint new budget committee members. And often in a community, we will have 3 to 5 brand new budget members, whether they're brand new to the school board or brand new to the budget committee process. We have equal numbers of community members as we do board members, and our board members appoint the community members. So in Salem-Keizer, we have 7 board members, and we appoint 7 community members. This year, I believe I have 5 that are brand new to the process, have never been on a budget committee or a school board through the budget process. So that's our work before December. And I put on the other side of this kind of the legislative process so you can see how that interacts for us. The governor recommends the budget, as you know, in December, about the time we're really launching our budget season. So the January through March time is for us to determine our current service level. I know that the legislative fiscal office determines the statewide. We do that internally for ourselves. We take our costs, we know what our drivers are, we know what our escalation will be, and we roll those up. We set priorities and begin that strategic planning. We organize the budget committee, do as much education as we can. Before we've even launched the budget committee process this year, I've spent time with my budget committee on class size, on organization, on what's the budget document look like, and behavioral learning, because that's one of our really big challenges. And then internally, we are developing the budget process. As you begin your work in the legislative session, we're putting the numbers in the software and working on our budget for the next year. We also do an estimation of what we think the revenue will be. We never put a number in that's the right number initially. We just go off of estimates, especially in that first year when you are in your full session and you are determining revenue. We're on the other side. We're thinking, okay, here's what we think it's going to be. Here's what the governor did. And we're doing that estimation. And we actually do it jointly across the state. We work well with ODE, and we work well with our other school district partners and with COSA and OSBA to be able to kind of understand what you're facing in revenue so we can help understand what the drivers are going to be within our own budget. So then April through May is actually where we start the public budget process. And on my chart, if it's in black on the Salem-Keizer side, it's an internal process. So if it's red, it's the public process, because they kind of go together. So the first time we share our budget publicly is at the superintendent's budget process message. That is a really hard thing for communities and budget committee members. And you've probably experienced this as lawmakers, but you're handed something that looks like it's really complete. and you've been asked to do something and you want to make changes and you want to have impact and you want to feel like you're on a committee that's doing something. But a good superintendent who understands the values of the community and the drivers and the strategic plan rarely has the budget committee change things within the budget process, because hopefully I've done the bulk of that work and that understanding ahead of it getting there. So I present them a big book. They want to be able to make changes, and they try to study it to understand what the drivers are within the budget. So we work that process through the months of April, May. We have lots of public comment period. We see what our community wants us to hear. And I'll tell you, the way the budget committee process works is if you cut a very important community value, you will hear about it in your but. So if I said I'm going to cut athletics, I would pack the budget committee, or if I needed to cut a music program, those things would pack the room, just like some of those issues do for you at times. And then, so once the budget committee approves it, they take a vote. The citizens part of the budget committee steps out and the board takes over. The board then holds their public hearing and then can adopt the budget with modifications. What I'll tell you is lots of times we fully adopt our budget. We've already been hiring teachers. We are already making classroom plans before you've finished your work. And that is the hardest thing for us, but we have learned ways to do the best we can with our crystal ball and hope that we're not too far off, because too far off to us means people. Generally, so you hope you have an overhired or underhired people in the process. So what drives our budget, our revenue? This is just a simple chart. I took out all the federal programs, $480 million in general fund revenue. Our salaries are over $250 million. PERS is almost $67 million. Health insurance, $63.5 million, and other associated payroll costs around $23 million. The people cost of our business is 84% of our revenue. And if we go back to what makes a difference for kids, it's people. Here's all the rest of the things that other 16% can be spent on. And I just threw them up there because it's always that competing demand of, do you put money into this or people? And at the end of the day, that's really hard, because you know the people change the mark for kids. There I did. So some impacts to our budget: revenue available from the state school fund, collective bargaining. I'm going to speak on behalf of two collective bargaining units in the state, because I bargained with two. I rarely have found them to be excessive in what they ask for at the table. Most often it's around working conditions, better things that will make it better for kids. You know, they'll ask for moderate cost of living increases, but of course, that's only within two school districts, but that's been my experience. Our teachers and our classified employees want what's best for kids. We have lots of increased costs outside of our control. For Salem-Keizer, we're expecting about a $17 million increase in our PERS rates in the first year of the next biennium, which is a $34 million increase to PERS over this next biennium. And then finally, legislative mandates without additional funding. That's our process in a quick nutshell. And I just want to tell you that my most important priority is to get as many resources as possible to students in the classroom while maintaining an infrastructure that doesn't fail. Buses, technology, wireless access, buildings, but to keep that not robust, but maintaining, and get resources to classrooms and the resources of the right teachers with the right curriculum with the right supports. All right, so pass it to my colleague, and you'll probably run out of time for questions.
Write down as you think of them any questions you might have, because they are a good resource.
Yeah.
And we will, is it online yet?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. So the PowerPoints are online, so you can look at those at your leisure as well.
While he's doing that, good afternoon, Senator Roblin, Vice Chair, not Senator Knott. My name's Tim Sweeney. I'm the superintendent of the Coquille School District on the South Coast. We're about 18 miles inland of Coos Bay. Much smaller district than Salem. We have about 1,150 students in the Coquille School District in grades K through 12, and we have another 50 students in pre-K, and then another 25 students in preschool. We operate a early learning center that has about, that has children 30 months and up. We have about 1,250 students that we serve throughout the district. Our poverty rate's about 70%, so each student in the district gets 3 meals a day. Students in the Early Learning Center get 5 meals a day. And those are reimbursed through ODE, and it's been a community enhancement program. It's been a huge deal for our district, made a big impact. We have about 64 licensed staff, 75 classified staff, roughly 150 total staff. Our budget's $10 million for the state school fund, and then additional $6 million through various programs that we have, title and so forth, so $16 million budget in Coquille. We run four schools, our early learning school for preschool through kindergarten, our elementary, first grade through six, and our high school, which is grade 7 through 12, and an alternative school that is a K-12 school. So that's kind of just a little bit about Coquille. With regards to the budget process, we begin in January. I just put this up January through December. We have our department heads and our building principals meet with our staff. They start talking about their needs for their classrooms or their programs and what's going on. Then they start talking to our technology director, our transportation director, so forth, to begin their part of the budgeting process. They will bring that information to me. I will meet with everybody individually, and we'll start formulating the budget as far as what we need on the ground. And we start that budget framework, it begins to take shape. In February, and this just happened a couple weeks back, the school board will meet and they will set forth the goals for the district. All right. And my goals are never like improve communication or anything like that. They're always pretty big goals, and I will show you those in a moment. And they don't always care that I have the money or the means to make it happen. They just expect me to make it happen. We do our best to meet their goals. And their goals drive the district as the elected officials. They really are the ones that push us to be better in Coquille. I've got a dynamic board. They're fun to work with. They're easy to work with, but they have high expectations for our district, and they push us. Once we have the board's direction and we match that with what the building needs are, we start really putting together our budget, and that happens in March and April. Now, I've told you we have a $16 million budget. This year's budget's gonna, once I get everybody's requests in, we'll come in around $20 million, and we'll start cutting that back because every principal will want three new teachers, or they'll lots of needs. So we'll have to make that work, but we will determine how we're going to move the district forward and continue to meet both the board's goals and our continuous improvement plan goals. So once the budget is built, we bring the budget committee together. We have a 15-person budget committee, 7 board members and 8 community members. Those folks take a look at the budget. They bring in their questions, their concerns, and make sure that we are moving everything the way that the board wants to see in the budget that their requests are built into the budget. Show us where, when we talk about this, where is that money at? So that's a key part of the budget committee process for us. We go over any substantial changes, and we determine anything as a substantial change as $10,000 or more. So if we've added a teacher, that would be a substantial change. If we've taken a hit in the state school fund, we would mention that there. And we go over that line by line with the budget committee. Budget committee votes to approve or send back the budget in June. Of course, we have to have it done by the 30th. If the budget's sent back, we revert to the February portion of the process and start again building with the board's goals in mind. In June, we sit down as an administrative team and say, okay, we've built the budget. We have these requests from the board. How do we make this work for the Coquille School District? And we start building our individual building goals around what the board's goals are. Then each administrator and department head provides, in August, each administrator and department head provides a detailed plan to meet the board's priorities. And then all major purchases are finalized by then. Then October and December, the board wants to see that if we've done a textbook adoption, they want that brought to them at a board meeting. Show us the textbook you bought, show us how you're using it, have a student there looking at it, working with them, working with the online portion or however that goes. If they've decided to do a program of robotics, they want to see the robot and the kids that are working with it at the board meetings. They want to see that their money that they've allocated is working the way they want it to do. Okay. And so we try to spotlight at each board meeting one or two of the board's goals and priorities. For the coming year, they've asked me to build a new career technical education center. A couple years back, we went to the OSBA meeting in Portland, and one of my board members heard about Salem Kaiser's 300,000 square foot CTE center and decided that they need one of those in Coquille. Not quite 300,000 square feet. And that they also heard that Salem Kaiser has two new CTE programs every year, and how great would that be? And I'm like, you can't add two new ones every year. You don't have the number of students to be in there. So, but we try. We do our best to meet that. So they want me to build a school on property I don't own with money I don't have. And that's a big goal. That's causing a lot of stress. They want me to continue to grow the enrollment in our Child Development Center and attempt to be financially solvent in that program. I've told them that was not going to happen, but they put it as a goal anyway. We don't actually generate from the state school fund for 30-month-olds. There's no way to be financially solvent, but they want us to have more partnerships. They want us to get more grants. They want us to offset the cost of the staffing with different things. They want me to work towards a bond. Our current bond rolls off in 2020. They insist on small class sizes, so our kindergarten class sizes are not allowed to be over 20. Our primary class sizes are not allowed to be over 23, and our intermediate class sizes are not allowed to be over 25. We fudge a little bit on that one. It's we can't do it all. It's staff's a lot of money. They want me to enhance the social media presence. Oh wait, I missed one there. We have a large chronic absentee rate in the Coquille School District. I think we're seventh, I guess you'd say, worse in the state of students that miss more than 2 days a month. And we have been directed by the board to be more creative with our curriculum that is more engaging to struggling learners, and we'll hook them into career pathways through the CTE programs, and which goes back to the CTE building I'm supposed to build. CTE pathways should be created after students are surveyed to find high interest. They don't want us to say, hey, we think this is cool. We want to hear from the students what they think is cool. And then you see the other ones there. We have our alternative school is Winter Lake School, and it's at the Pioneer Methodist Church in town, which is in right downtown. And the city would really like to open up a marijuana dispensary near there, but our school is in the way. It's a small town, so we have the entire town covered by schools. So they'd like us to move, and so the board would like me to have a backup plan in case they force us to leave there. So,
for marijuana.
But Coquille does not have a marijuana dispensary, and it's nice. You know, you go through some of these communities and you see them every few feet. That just gives you an idea of what we're doing in Coquille. We really believe that the board drives the engine. And if you come down in February of next year, because that's 1 year, they'll want to be able to walk through the halls of this school. We will have something for them to walk through. I don't know if you saw it, Senator, in the paper, that we have hired an architect to draw up some plans, and we've made an offer on some property. So we think we'll have something that'll be about 5,000 square feet, not 300,000. That's a big facility. It's cool. And if you have questions on how we budget in Coquille, please ask. It's really driven by the board and the budget committee, what they want for their town.
We'll do one question, because Hans got his hand up really quick.
I have just one question for Superintendent Perry. It's a little bit off of budget, but right at the beginning, we were just discussing this just before we came down here, and I remarked about how the Beaverton School District has like 80 different languages, and how could that be? And nobody believed me. Mm-hmm. And
no, we believed you. Somebody believed you.
Yeah. What does that really look like, though? How does that work? I don't think I could name 80 countries, and I came up with about 20 different languages, but what does that really mean?
So I can tell you what it means for kids. I don't know how we get to all the languages, but I could get that for you. So I could get you the list of languages. But the bulk of our students are Spanish-speaking, and we tailor programs for them with bilingual teachers that teach those that are bilingual in Spanish, especially at the elementary level. For our other students, where there's not a high density, you can't cluster them in classrooms because they're usually across five or six different schools, we try to be sure we can translate materials, and we have teachers that are endorsed with ESOL, English as a Second Language endorsement. So their services are in a regular classroom, and the regular classroom teacher, who's usually primarily an English speaker, has learned strategies for bridging language and helping language development.
We can follow up.
Yeah, please. Mm-hmm.
So if I'm a student from Slovenia and I come into your school, does that mean now you are required to find a teacher to have that particular language or dialect, or what is that?
Yeah, we take seriously the requirement around translating material, or especially the parent material in their home language. And that is one really tricky piece, even though we have a translation department. But we put those students in with an English-only speaking teacher with the ESOL endorsement. So we don't have a requirement that we have to teach in the language. We have a legal requirement for 30 minutes of ELD, English Language Development Instruction, from a teacher like with an ESOL endorsement. It's tricky, but it's the strategies of language development that we're sure our teachers have.
And if I could just follow up, what percentage of your budget, how significant is this with 79 different languages?
Let me get back to you with that question, because I can tell you the number's large for our Spanish-speaking population, but if they were English-speaking, they'd be in a school with a classroom teacher. So some of our classrooms that are bilingual classrooms, 100% of the kids in the classroom are Spanish-speaking with a Spanish-speaking teacher teaching them English. So it's hard to identify exactly what the number is, but I'll kind of do a list of here's the types of funding that would go to this. So for us, it's a whole translation department. It's lots of bilingual assistants out in schools, and teachers for our bilingual Spanish-speaking kids that are Spanish-speaking.
Is it a state requirement that you translate materials into the language of the person, or is that something the school district has found they had to do?
I believe it's actually either a state or a federal requirement.
Okay. So that's exactly the kind of questions you should write down, and we will get back to some more. But I thought that was a good exchange, and I appreciate that answer. I want to thank both of you, because this is partly what I want us to start looking at as we go out. Here's a large school district which has different kinds of problems than a small school district, but the reality is, when you're sitting in that superintendent's chair, it's the same problem. I mean, I've got X amount of things I have to get done. I've got a board that wants me to get those things done. And what resources am I going to pull together in each of these different communities to meet those needs of those kids? And I appreciate both of you being here. So,
yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I look forward to listening to your test on tape. So thank you for being here.
And I did tell them ahead of time that you were going to do that, and you have been really good at it. So we're going to close this informational hearing, and thank you both for being here, and you will probably be hearing from us. All right. Next, we did have on our list Doug Wilson, but he's available to us all the time, so we're not going to bring him up right now. And we're going to ask another person who's usually here to do it as quickly as we can, so we can have some time for auditors, because we have a person on this committee who loves auditors. So we're going to open a short an informational on state funding formula with Brian Reeder.
And Michael.
Hold on. And we're going to keep the questions down, just because we want to get to the last one, because the auditors, the Taylor Tony auditors, are the most important people. So yes, please.
Co-Chair Roblin, Co-Vice Chair Knope, members of the committee, Brian Reeder with the Research Office at the Department of Education, joined by Mike Wiltfong, who's the Director of our School Finance Office. I'll go through this fairly quickly in the interest of time. I want to talk a little bit today about Oregon's funding formula. A little bit of history here. School funding history in Oregon starts with Measure 5. Anything before that is of little interest anymore, to tell you the truth. Measure 5 cut property taxes dramatically in Oregon, particularly for education. School tax rates in Oregon, when you take into account K-12, community colleges, and ESDs, were in the $15 to $20 per thousand range. In most communities, Measure 5 limited that to $5 per thousand and required that the state legislature make up the difference. After Measure 5 was in place for 5 or 6 years, and property values continued to grow rapidly in Oregon, the voters passed Measure 47, which was unworkable. So the legislature took Measure 50 to the voters, which they passed, and Measure 50 provided the details to make the intent of Measure 47 workable. What Measure 50 did was to set permanent tax rates for every taxing district in the state. That includes cities, counties, school districts, all of them. It also cut assessed values to a level, I believe, something like 10% below the level they were 2 years prior, so in 1995. And then it limited the growth rate in assessed value to 3% a year for a given property. The consequences of that, one of the biggest was the increased volatility of education funding in Oregon. We cut back on property taxes, replaced that with income taxes. Income tax revenue is much more volatile than property tax revenue, particularly property tax revenue under Measure 50, which has permanent rates and controlled growth in assessed value. that major change that Measure 5 put in place also provided an incentive for the legislature to create the current school funding formula. If most of the money was going to come from the state, then allocating it in an equitable manner becomes paramount. And so the current funding formula was put in place. It made the state the primary funding source for K-12 schools. And it also made the state what I call the marginal source of revenue. And by marginal, I mean if more money is going to flow to K-12 schools, it has to come from the state. There's really no other place for it to come from. The one exception is really local option taxes. We have, I think, 22 school districts that have local option taxes. They do represent meaningful revenue, significant revenue for those districts, but statewide, they represent less than 3% of the total operating funds that school districts have. So important, but quite small. Here's a graph that shows history of revenue sources since the passage of Measure 5 in 1990. You can see the red line is local revenue, the blue line is state, and the black line above is the sum of those two, the total revenue flowing into Oregon's funding formula. You see the state and the local lines cross down there. That is the impact of Measure 5. Local revenue falls, state revenue rises to make that up, and then over time, you can see how stable local revenue growth is, and you can see how volatile state revenue is. Here is a look at funding per student, and in this case, funding per what we call ADMR, or average daily membership. Over time, it does grow over time. It's grown at over this period about 2.8% a year on average. Fair amount of variation, you can see. This is formula revenue, so it's both state and local funds that flow into the formula and then out to school districts. This next graph looks quite similar, but this is per weighted student, and we'll talk a little bit about what the weights are here in a minute. Again, growth over time. Now, growth in this, rather than 2.8% like funding per ADMR, it's about 2.5% on average per year for ADMW. That's because ADMW is growing faster than ADMR. In other words, the number of students with extra needs in Oregon, as measured by the weights, is growing faster than the general student population. Now we adjust funding per student, or funding per ADMW, for inflation. And to me, this is the most important view of the financial data that I can provide you. We have not kept up with inflation. And I think we see the consequences of that. Higher class sizes, all that goes along with that. Lower attendance, slow growth in student achievement. Let's talk a little bit about the formula itself, what its goals are. The core mission of the formula is to distribute funding in an equitable way. Now, equity means different things to different people. But what the formula does, in effect, is define what is meant by funding equity and then creates a system of student weights so that we distribute funds to individual school districts in a way that is considered equitable. And we define, or we operationalize, our view of equity by how we set those weights. The weights are really intended to adjust for differential costs of serving different types of students, students in different circumstances, costs that are really outside the control of school districts. So they face costs that they have no control over because of circumstances related to either student characteristics or, in some cases, school and district circumstances. Then the formula's intent is to compensate for those so that every school district in the state has an equal opportunity to serve the particular student populations they have in a way that all students can succeed. It is about inter-district equity across districts. Equity across districts.
There we go.
And we also distribute, the formula distributes funds to ESDs. In effect, it distributes them in the same way. It's based on the funding of their component districts. Therefore, it is based, in essence, on the ADMW of the districts that they serve. I touched on some of these points already. Equity is based on the principle of adjusting for cost differentials that districts can't control. Most of those are cost differentials driven by student characteristics, special education students, English language learners, students in poverty, so forth. A few of them, though, are based on characteristics of the districts themselves. For example, transportation costs vary tremendously around the state, a function primarily of student density and distances traveled. We have some districts in the state that spend over $2,000 per student simply to get their kids to and from school. The statewide average is between $200 and $300, so massive differences in transportation costs. The formula compensates for that. School size. We have some districts with very small schools, what I would consider necessarily small schools because they are so remote. They get additional resources to compensate for that smallness. And as we all know, but I'm here to remind you anyway, that districts in Oregon have a lot of freedom to spend their resources as they choose in ways that best benefit their particular student populations. We do not attach a lot of strings to the money that we send to school districts through the formula. So here's a graph that shows how the formula distributes funds. And each of these bars is a school district in Oregon, and they are, the blue part of the graph shows the share of their formula revenue that comes from their own local sources, and the red bar is the share that comes from state sources. And you can see that there's a lot of variation in the local versus state share.
It also shows there's four districts that don't get any money from the state. Everything comes from the local government.
That's correct, Co-Chair Roebling. We have four districts, and I can't name them right now, that have sufficient revenue from their own sources that they don't qualify for any additional state funds. The key point to this, though, is that every district, these are per weighted student numbers, so every district gets almost the same amount per weighted student. The only differences are caused by what we call a teacher experience adjustment, where districts with higher experienced teachers and therefore higher salaried teachers get extra money through the formula.
Am I seeing that wrong, or was there one district that was all state school fund?
There's a tiny bit of local funds down at the bottom.
That's why I couldn't.
But yes, and I couldn't tell you who that is.
It might be blind.
Oh, the school for.
We have a couple of schools that are state run schools.
Just the deaf.
But is that in that group?
No.
Okay, they're not in.
Co-Chair Roebling, Co-Chair Smith Warner, these are just school districts.
Okay.
And I believe Mike tells me that may be French Glen. school district, very small district, very small local tax base, and therefore local revenue.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think this is a really important graph because it shows that without this equalization, say we just did it, you know, back in the old days, you know, I know you think before 90s,
right.
No interest, but there was a system of what people call the haves and the have-nots. And I'm guessing those top four there are Beaverton or Portland, Wilsonville, and those places with lots of property value. And a lot of people would like to go back to that. And but that's you can see how dramatic that have and have not problem would be.
Yeah, it'd be the blue all by itself.
If we didn't have this.
So a little bit about the mechanics of the formula. There's the first thing we do, and Mike can help me fill in some of the details here. First thing we do when we determine how much money each district gets is we skim some money off the top, and we don't keep it for ourselves. So, and these are what we call carve-outs. They are specific programs approved by the legislature where money is distributed to school districts in different ways other than through the weighted student approach. And I've got a little bit about the specific ones later in this presentation. We may not want to devote much time to that since then you can read this.
We've got about 5 minutes and then we're going to go. So I'll tell my auditors that I apologize and we'll invite them back, and I hope that they come back because the Senate starts in about 5 minutes.
House as well. We are also reconvening it too.
Are you too? Okay. So.
Otherwise, I could swap out House
exactly.
members for all the senators.
That would have been nice, actually.
Yeah. So I'm gonna scroll ahead to the weights, the actual weights in the formula. Every student gets what we call the first weight or the basic weight, which is a weight of one. And then the additional weights are on top of that. So as you can see, for special education, an added full weight, ESL or English language learners, an extra half weight, students in poverty, an extra quarter weight, foster care, what we call neglected and delinquent programs run by DHS. Districts with those students get additional weights for those students as well. And then down at the bottom, the weights that we provide to districts with very small schools. There's really two separate versions of it. We tend to lump it together and call it the small school correction. It's for schools that are what I would term inefficiently small, where you may have a school with 5, 10, 20, 30 students in it, which results in class sizes of 3 and 4 and 7 students, which I think by any analysis is lower than is truly, getting to that small of a class size really has very little benefit relative to, say, being at 15 students per classroom. So it's very expensive to run those schools, but they're very remote, and transporting students long distances for school every day is both unfair to those students and probably detrimental to their well-being, and itself very expensive. So here's the formula itself. It starts with a fixed amount per weighted student, $4,500. It adds in, there we go. It adds in $25 for every year that a district's teacher experience differs from the statewide average. So if you have more experienced teachers, you get $25 per weighted student more for each of those years that you differ from the state. If you're below the state average, you get $25 less. That's the source of the slight differences in that bar graph I showed you. And then once we allocate the money out to districts, we have what we call the funding ratio, which, you know, at $4,500 per weighted student, we don't allocate all the money at that point. So we scale every district up until we've distributed all the money. Mm-hmm. I think today we're at roughly
7,680.
Okay, roughly $7,700 per weighted student is where we're at today. So that funding ratio is at about 1.6, I think. That's just the mechanics of the formula itself. We send money out to ESDs. 4.5% of the total goes to ESDs, distributed essentially based on weighted students of their component districts. And then the smallest ESDs have a minimum that they get. The minimum was set at initially $1 million, and we've now scaled it to the growth in the state school fund, so it's currently at about $1.3 million. Really four main lessons to take from this is that the purpose of the formula is funding equity across school districts. And I think our formula does that well, with the caveat that it only can do it well if the weights are set properly. And the weights are essentially the same as they were when the formula was created in the early 90s. Revisiting those weights in a serious way to determine whether they are still at the level that meets our equity goals, I think, is a good idea. The formula distributes both state and local money, and obviously we don't have the districts pay us their revenue from local sources and then just give it back to them, but we do take into account their local revenue when we calculate how much they're going to get from the state, so that equalization can take place. And the weights really are based on characteristics of students that are associated with differential costs. And that's where the equity comes in, is compensating districts for costs that they don't, or that they don't have control over.
We're gonna have to go because it is about 2 o'clock. We'll call you back to finish so that I know you were ready for questions, so I appreciate that. And if we have more questions, we'll let you ask one question, then I'm gonna gavel.
Well, I just wanted to make it clear that we're not talking about each student costing the same amount. Elementary school students cost a lot less than middle school students, than high school students, because you have to have different programs for them. So although you may have a certain amount per student going into a district, it's not as if that's going to pay for all of the needs of every student.
Well, our
formula accounts for that.
Our goal is to distribute money to districts equally and fairly.
Right.
It is not telling the school districts how to spend that money on their individual units within the district. That's a district responsibility. It's what at the beginning Mr. Reeder had explained, in that we don't put a lot of strings attached to it, so we don't say what you can spell for an elementary person. You have to figure that out yourself. Here's your pot of money based on this equity plan that we have developed a long time ago and hasn't changed. And
I would like to reinforce the idea that it hasn't changed since we first put
exactly.
this together, and there's a lot of interesting research I would love to us to talk more about really what the impacts of poverty and other things.
So we don't get our respective speakers and members upset with us. We're going to adjourn us up. We're going to say thank you. We're going to adjourn our informational meeting. We're going to thank the wonderful auditors in the back. I don't want to make sure that I don't express how important it is that they're here.
Those are my people.
I know. That's what I'm trying to say. And with that, we're going to close the Student Success Committee. Thank you all for being here.